Lecture 21, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, November 1st, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Welcome back. Last time where we left off with was developing the theory of phonons and solids. We motivated this by recognizing that the electrons themselves could not explain thermal properties of materials. It turns out that free electron theory can't explain a lot of things in materials, so we have to add the nuclei into the mix. And in particular, they manifest themselves as these lattice vibrations or phonons. Before we can develop any theory utilizing phonons, we first have to establish the dispersion relation, the omega-k relationship. It's always the first step in any solid-state physics problem. And so that's what we started to do last time. We made the simplest approximation of one atom per primitive cell and derived the following dispersion relation. So if you recall, that dispersion relation had the following form. Omega was equal to 4 over C, the force constant, divided by the mass of the atom, times the absolute value of sine, Ka over 2, where A is the spacing between the atoms. K is, of course, the wave vector, and that's what we're trying to develop, is the relationship between omega and K. And so we could write this down as a plot, plotting omega versus K. We recognize that the critical points are going to occur at pi over A, 2 pi over A, 3 pi over A, etc. And so I'll label those points on the graph. One thing that's important to recognize is that unlike for free electrons, which we did in the first week of the course, here we see the dispersion relation is periodic. That's something which is going to show up many times in solid-state physics, resulting from the periodicity of the lattice. And in particular, the critical point in this diagram is the so-called first Brillouin zone, which is between minus pi over A and pi over A. Because this is periodic, if we plot what happens in the first Brillouin zone, then we know what happens for all values of K. And so that'll be what is typically done in solid-state physics. We recognize that this sine function has an amplitude square root 4c over m. And we'll have a shape which looks like this. It's the absolute value. So of course, everything stays above the x-axis. Okay, so this is what it would look like. This actually is not a bad approximation for one of the two most common modes of phonons in solids, so-called acoustical mode. But there's another mode known as the optical phonon mode, which is not at all included in this description. And so it tells us that we have to add more complexity to our model to explain the simplest qualitative description of a solid. In a real solid, of course, you're going to have three dimensions, not just one dimension. You can have a phonon spectrum, which is actually quite complicated. And if you move on in solid-state physics, you'll look at more and more complicated phonon spectra. In this course, though, I just want to go one step further to introduce the optical branch of the phonon spectrum, because the optical and acoustical modes will explain 90% of the important properties of phonons and solids. Okay. Is everybody okay with up to this point? All right. So what we want to do now is somehow add complexity to our model to include the optical modes in addition to the acoustical modes. And what we'll do is reanalyze this dispersion relation instead of for one atom per primitive cell, for two atoms per primitive cell. And there are famous examples from introductory material science. For example, the sodium chloride crystal structure or the diamond crystal structure. What we're going to do is assume that we have one force constant, but two different masses for the two atoms in the primitive cell. You can reanalyze this problem assuming the same mass, that is the same atom, but at two inequivalent positions, and you'll get the same qualitative result. Some textbooks will do that. For example, Ashcroft and Merman's textbook does it that way. We'll do this the way that Cattell does it, assuming two different masses. The results are the same. So let's try to draw this schematically. We're going to assume that there's two different masses. I'm going to label one as an open circle, one as a closed circle. Again, we're assuming one dimension here. We'll say this is mass 1, and this is mass 2. We'll say that the periodicity of the lattice is A, so that's going to be between two equivalent atoms. We're going to label the displacements in terms of two values, U sub S for the M1 sites, and V sub S for the M2 sites. And of course, there'll be a U sub S plus 1, V sub S plus 1, etc. And similarly, there'll be a V sub S minus 1 and a U sub S minus 1, etc. Okay. So this is our model. What we're going to do is analyze this just as we did before, assuming nearest neighbor interactions dominate. Okay. So as I said, we will assume one force constant. In two different masses. This will qualitatively capture the behavior of most solids. Okay. But if you want to practice, you could reanalyze this problem for two inequivalent positions with the same mass, which would manifest itself as two different force constants, but the same mass, and you get the same qualitative result. But we'll do it following Cattell today and assume that nearest neighbor interactions dominate. And as a result, we can write down Newton's laws. In particular, let's consider the atom of mass m sub 1. Its acceleration will be the second time derivative of its displacement, u sub s. So mass times acceleration will equal the net force. The net force will be the force constant. Now looking at nearest neighbor interactions, there'll be one displacement, which is the difference between u sub s and v sub s, and the second, which will be u sub s and v sub s minus 1. And so we'll write this down immediately as V sub S plus V sub S minus 1 minus 2 U sub S. Whereas last time we explicitly wrote down V sub S minus U sub S and V sub S minus 1 minus U sub S. I just combined them together. Okay. So this is just a statement of Newton's laws. We could analyze the same situation for the atom of mass 2, M sub 2. Its acceleration would, of course, be the second derivative of its displacement, which is V sub S. And this will be equal to C times now U sub S plus 1 plus U sub S minus 2 V sub S. Again, the relevant displacements in this case would be U sub S plus 1 minus V sub S and U sub S minus V sub S. So we'll have two terms of V sub S. And of course, what we're going to seek are traveling wave solutions. We're looking for the phonon modes. The traveling wave solutions will be of the form that U sub S will equal to some amplitude U times e to the I S K A times e to the minus I omega T. And V sub S will be equal to some amplitude V times e to the I S Ka e to the negative I omega t. Again, analogous to what we did last time, the only difference is that we have two different amplitudes here, u and v. We simply plug this in. One thing we recognize is that when we plug it in, the second time derivative will just pull out two terms of negative I omega, negative I omega quantity squared is negative omega squared. And so we can write this down as negative omega squared m sub 1 times u, recognizing that every term in this equation is going to have a term e to the I ska and e to the negative I omega t. So I'm just going to divide them through immediately. This will be equal to c times v, the quantity 1 plus e to the negative ika. Why is this the case? Well, this term here is just going to go as e to the iska, whereas this term here will have an e to the iska times e to the negative ika. So that's the only term that survives. Minus 2 times c times u. This is just evaluated at s, so when we divide through by e to the iska and e to the negative I omega t, all we're left with is the amplitude u. So I've skipped a couple steps here, hoping that you recall what we did last time. Okay? It's just math. The next equation will become negative omega squared m sub 2 times v. This will be equal to c times u, e to the ika plus 1 minus 2c times v. Why? Because this is s plus 1, so we're going to get an e to the ika term. This is just s, we get a term unity. And this is, again, a term s, so we get a term unity. Okay. So we've reduced this down to a series of two equations and two unknowns. The two unknowns are u and v. And in principle, we could solve for u and v, but what we're after is not what the amplitudes are, but rather what the dispersion relation is between omega and k. And this is something that will happen as you go on in solid state physics, is you get to a point where you could solve for the unknowns, but you really don't care what the unknowns are, just that there is a non-zero solution. This will be true when we go to band structure. We could solve for the wave functions, but we really don't care about the wave functions. We care about the dispersion relation, that is the band structure. And that we can determine by simply showing that there is a solution to this 2x2 series of equations. So this is a big moment in solid state, because you're going to use this trick over and over again. Or in this case, we recognize that this 2x2 series of equations has a non-zero solution only if the determinant of the coefficients of the unknowns, which are u and v in this case, vanishes. So this is a trick from linear algebra. If you have an n by n series of equations, then you'll know that there is a non-zero solution only if the determinant of that n by n matrix made up of the coefficients of the unknowns vanishes. That is, it is equal to zero. So the beauty of this is that you can generalize it to an n by n equations, which you'll do in solid-state physics. Solid-state physics, to determine dispersion relations or to determine band structure, boils down to taking determinants of an arbitrarily large matrix. Obviously, the larger the matrix, the more accurate the solution you'll have. In this case, we've assumed just nearest neighbor interactions. We only have a 2x2 series of equations. But if you assume second nearest neighbor, third nearest neighbor, etc., the matrix would grow. But the approach would be identical. So we have to write down what the determinant is. In the first equation, the coefficient in front of u, if we move everything on the right-hand side to the left-hand side, we can see that the coefficient in front of u will become 2 times c minus m1 omega squared. The coefficient in front of v will become negative c 1 plus e to the negative ika. For the second equation, again, moving everything to the left-hand side, the coefficient in front of u becomes negative c times 1 plus e to the ika, and the coefficient in front of v will become 2c minus m2 omega squared. We set that determinant equal to 0. Okay. 2x2 is a nice case because it's very easy to evaluate the determinant. You just take the diagonal going from upper left to lower right, take the product of those two terms and subtract the product of the other diagonal, and set it equal to 0. And what that will then give us is an equation for omega, which we can solve in terms of k, the dispersion relation. That's exactly what we're seeking. Okay. Everybody comfortable with the approach? If so, then it's just math at this point. We'll execute it. We'll take the determinant. The first diagonal will be negative, will be 2c minus m1 omega squared times 2c minus m2 omega squared minus the other diagonal, which will be c squared times 1 plus e to the negative I ka times 1 plus e to the I ka, and set that equal to 0. Now what we're going to do is some algebra here to simplify this. We have to take this product. The first term will become 4c squared. The last term will be plus m1, m2, omega to the fourth. Then we have the cross terms, which will be negative 2c times the quantity m1 plus m2 omega squared. Then we'll execute the second product. We'll get negative c squared times the quantity. The first term is 1. The second term is also 1 because these are complex conjugates. The sum of them, 1 plus 1 is 2, plus the cross terms, e to the ika plus e to the negative ika, which is equal to 0. We're then going to do one final simplification. In particular, we'll take the first term as the omega to the fourth term. That'll be m1, m2, omega to the fourth. Then we'll take the second term, which is the omega squared term, negative 2c, m1 plus m2, omega squared. We'll then recognize that 4c squared minus 2c squared is just 2c squared. We'll then pull out in front of this term here, plus 2c squared. We'll get a term 1 from the sum of those two terms. E to the ik plus e to the minus ika is 2 cosine ka, so we can pull the 2 out in front, and again get a 2c squared term. So this will become the quantity 1 minus cosine ka, which is equal to 0. This cosine term is important because it then suggests that, again, we'll find a periodicity in the dispersion relation. Now, at this point, we could use the quadratic equation to solve this exactly. In terms of omega squared, take the square root of the resulting quadratic formula, and you would have your answer. That answer is not particularly neat, as you can probably see by inspection. It's kind of a mess. And it's not particularly intuitive. If I asked you to draw what that would look like, I think it would be difficult for me to do it, at least. And so what we'll do instead is consider the limiting behavior of this equation, and the limit of k being very small, and also k at the Brillouin zone boundary. And from that, we'll be able to deduce what the shape of this curve is for all values of k. Okay. So let me just write that down explicitly. If you are so inclined, you could use the quadratic formula from algebra. So you could use the quadratic formula . The exact solution can be determined. But, as I just suggested, the limiting behavior is more instructive. The limiting behavior will tell us how these phonon modes behave and will allow us to deduce properties of solids without resorting to a computer to do this mathematics for us. So let's look at the limiting behavior. The first limiting case will be Ka being very small, so this will be near zero. And this, of course, implies that we can Taylor series expand cosine, and it will be approximately equal to 1 minus 1 half k squared a squared. There'll be higher order terms, but those we will neglect in this case. K because if Ka is small, then the higher order terms become very small and negligible. We're going to take this and recognize that we're taking 1 minus cosine Ka, so the zeroth order term will cancel, and we just get something which goes as k squared a squared, and plug it in to this equation. So we'll do that. We'll get out that m1, m2, omega to the fourth, minus 2c, m1, plus m2, omega squared, plus, now when we insert this Taylor series expansion, we just get out c squared, k squared, a squared is equal to 0. Now this is a quadratic equation, which you can factor. So if you think back to your days of algebra, you could factor this equation. I'm just going to write down the two results. There'll be two solutions for omega squared. The first solution will be equal to 2 times c times 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2. And the second solution, which will be equal to 1 half c divided by m1 plus m2 k squared a squared. Remember, this is what we were seeking. We were seeking two solutions, the acoustical branch and the optical branch. And so the fact that we get two answers here is a good sign. Again, if you want to brush up on your factoring, you could go ahead and show that this is in fact the case. What I want to point out is that one of the solutions is constant with respect to k. There's no k dependence here. So it implies a constant dispersion relation. And that's in fact what we'll find qualitatively is that for the optical phonon modes, the dispersion relation is relatively flat. And as a result, when we develop a theory to calculate the thermal properties of materials, there'll be one limiting case where we'll assume a constant dispersion relation. That was the model of Einstein, and that will be one model we'll consider. And we'll find that the Einstein model describes the thermal behavior of optical phonons relatively accurately as a result of this dispersion relation being constant with respect to k. The other one, of course, if we took the square root of both sides, we see omega is linear in k. This is a linear dispersion relation. And if you recall, for the case of one atom per primitive cell, the previous analysis, that's exactly what we found. In the case of small k, we had a linear behavior. And as a result, the phonons will behave very similarly to the classical theory of elastic waves, with some velocity, the sound velocity in the material, dictating the linear relationship between omega and k. That'll be the other limiting case. This will be known as the Debye model, and will describe the behavior, the thermal behavior of materials in the case of the acoustical phonon modes. So I quite like this analysis because in 20 minutes we can derive these fundamental relationships for optical phonons and acoustical phonons, and therefore explain why in the next lecture there are differences in the thermal properties of those two phonon modes, the acoustical and the optical. Everybody comfortable so far? So that's one limiting case. Let's consider the other limiting case. That will be at the zone boundary, where Ka equals plus or minus pi. Remember, the zone boundary occurs where K equals plus or minus pi over A. This is the zone boundary. In this case, if cosine of plus or minus pi is equal to negative 1, and so the last term in our quadratic equation will now become 4c squared, and as a result, we can write down that the equation now becomes m1, m2, omega to the fourth, minus 2c, m1 plus m2, omega squared, plus 4c squared is equal to 0. Again, this can be factored. This one's easier to factor. The two results will be that omega squared is equal to 2c over m1, or omega squared is equal to 2c over m2. And what we see is that at the zone boundaries, these are both constant dispersion relations. And so that suggests that near the zone boundary, the phase velocity of the phonons is going to go to zero. That's what we found before for the acoustical modes, if you recall. It implies the formation of a standing wave at the zone boundaries. So with this said, we can now draw what the dispersion relation is. We know that all the action occurs in the first Brillouin zone. So we won't even bother writing down anything else. We now know, without saying it explicitly, that the dispersion relation is periodic. The critical terms are, at the Brillouin zone boundary, we see that there's two values of omega. Omega could be equal to the square root of 2c over m1, or the square root of 2c over m2. Where obviously I'm assuming that m1 is greater than m2 in this case. If it was the opposite, then these two would just flip over. So if m1 is greater than m2, then the reciprocal, of course, will be less than the reciprocal of 1 over m2. We know that the behavior is linear for the bottom branch, the acoustical branch. And so it's going to look something like this, which will turn over. Okay, so this looks very similar to what we had before. The acoustical branch remains unchanged qualitatively. The acoustical branch in the limit of small k is linear in k. On the other hand, for the optical branch, we know that in the limit of k going to 0, we just showed that omega is equal to square root 2c times 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2. So we're going to have a term here. Sorry, this is getting a little cluttered. This term on the y-axis will become square root of 2c of 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2. Okay. And it'll be relatively constant, so it's going to look something like this. Now, if one of these masses is much greater, for example, if m1 is much greater than m2, then this term will become negligible, and this will become completely flat. Okay, so any asymmetry will lead to this phonon, optical phonon mode becoming flatter and flatter. And so it's going to be a reasonable approximation to say that this is perfectly flat, and that's what Einstein did in his model, which we'll look at either later today or next time. Okay. So this would be the so-called optical branch. It's not at all clear yet why they're called acoustical and optical, but I'll tell you that in a minute. Another important thing to notice is that at the zone boundary, there's an opening of a gap, a frequency gap, a forbidden frequency gap. There'll be certain frequencies in a solid where you cannot have phonon modes. This would become analogous to the energy band gap, which you've probably heard of before. This is the phonon equivalent of it. Okay, so this is a very famous picture. If you understand this picture, you basically understand everything there is to know about the dispersion relation of phonons. Okay. There are some, of course, subtleties. As you go to more complicated materials, you'll find so-called Van Hove singularities will emerge in the phonon density of states. You can read about that if you want, or learn about it in a later course. But this qualitatively will describe the thermal properties of most materials. So let's now examine why on earth I'm calling these acoustical and optical phonon modes. To do that, what I want you to do is consider the behavior at k equals 0. And if we went back to the first equation we wrote down, these were the Newton's laws equations we wrote down, and we plugged in k equals 0, what we would find is that the first equation will become negative omega squared m1 times u is equal to 2cv minus 2 Cu, because we had a term which went as e to the ika and k equals 0, that's just equal to 1. Therefore, if we look at the optical branch, also at k equals 0, we showed that omega is equal to the square root of 2c times the sum of the reciprocal of the masses. Okay. And as a result, if we plugged this into this equation, we'll take the square of this and we'll execute some math, we'll get out negative 2c times 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2 times m1u is equal to 2cv minus 2cu. Of course, we can divide through by 2c, because that's a common term on both sides of the equation, and multiply through. We multiply through, 1 over m1 times m1 is just 1. We have a negative sign out in front. So we're going to get negative u minus m1 over m2 times u is equal to v minus u. The negative u's will cancel on both sides. We could then solve for the reciprocal, or I'm sorry, the ratio of u to v. The ratio of u to v is equal to negative m2 over m1. What's important to notice here is that this is equal to a constant, but a negative constant, since masses are implicitly positive. And so what it tells you is that the adjacent displacements are 180 degrees out of phase. Okay. So for an optical phonon mode, we're going to have the opposite displacement between adjacent atoms in the lattice, which will imply a very high frequency oscillation. And that makes sense, because we see that the optical phonon modes occur for high frequencies. Okay. So this implies that the atoms vibrate against each other ...180 degrees out of phase. And in particular, if you had a solid, for example, sodium chloride, where the adjacent atoms are the opposite charge, the sodium being positively charged, the chlorine being negatively charged in the sodium chloride structure, then what you're going to have is a very high frequency oscillating electromagnetic field generated. And as a result, it's quite easy to generate these optical phonons or excite them using time-varying electromagnetic radiations at high frequencies. And of course, light is a perfect example of that. Light is a high-frequency electromagnetic field, and as a result, you can excite these so-called optical phonon modes using optical irradiation, hence the name optical phonon mode. So to summarize, if the atoms possess opposite charges, the motion of the atoms can be excited by the electric field of light, hence optical. So let's now reanalyze the situation for the acoustical mode. You can tell just from the dispersion relation that it's going to match that of the classical theory of elastic waves, which of course is the theory of sound, and hence you could already see why it's called an acoustical mode. But we'll look at the analysis just a little bit more in depth and show that the acoustical modes are low frequency modes, which we can see from our dispersion relation already. But physically, it'll make sense. So let's look at the acoustical branch. In particular, the acoustical branch, since it's linear, the dispersion relation is linear, this will imply that omega equals zero. And if omega equals 0, that immediately implies that u equals v. And as a result, the atoms move together, analogous to long wavelength, that is short frequency acoustic vibrations. And hence we call them acoustical phonon modes. Okay. The last thing that I'll point out, as I already stated in words, but let's write it down explicitly, is that wave-like solutions do not for frequencies between square root 2c over m1 and square root of 2c over m2, which implies a frequency gap at the zone boundary. Since phonons basically behave like harmonic oscillator, then we know that the energy will be of the order of h bar times omega, and so a frequency gap also implies an energy gap. And this is something which is universal to solid-state physics, and we'll now examine this for the next week, is that any periodic system will imply the opening of an energy band gap. This is something which is universal in solid-state physics. True for phonons, but also be true for the electrons, which we're going to have to revisit. Okay. So just to drive this point home, let's take a look at a figure, which will depict the two types of phonons, acoustical and optical. And the important point is that when we looked at the analysis, for the optical modes, the adjacent atoms would move in opposite directions. So here they're labeled explicitly as some positively charged ion and some negatively charged ion, like sodium and chlorine respectively, and sodium chloride. And they're moving in the opposite directions. And as a result, you get this very high frequency oscillation. Because they're oppositely charged, it'll apply a high frequency electromagnetic field. And so you can excite these optical phonon modes using optical radiation. On the other hand, the acoustical modes, the displacements are in the same direction. They're in phase. And as a result, you're going to get a relatively long wavelength mode, which is excited. This long wavelength mode will have a linear dispersion relation and will be analogous to the acoustical theory of waves. And as a result, it's known as an acoustical mode. Okay. So, any questions? Yes?
Does that mean that light and sound will increase the temperature of the solid?
Absolutely. If you can input energy into the solid, then you'll definitely heat it up. And so that will be the case. We know this, that if we shine light on a sample, it will begin to heat up. And it's ultimately through the generation of phonons.
Is the inverse true also? Or increasing the temperature
of light? That is true for a different reason. That's the theory of black body radiation, which we'll be coming to next. So yeah, you're one step ahead of me. But yeah, that's exactly where we're going. We'll find this is true for any so-called black body, that as you heat it up, that you will be able to generate light. And the light which you generate, the power irradiated per unit area, will go as temperature to the fourth power. This is the famous Stefan Boltzmann law of black body radiation, and we will derive that next. So yeah, the theory of phonons and photons are very intimately related to one another. And fundamentally, this can be attributed to the fact that they're both bosons. And so bosons will behave qualitatively similar to one another, and fundamentally different from fermions. Question?
What's the magnitude of the displacements?
Well, we know the absolute maximum it could be would be the spacing between the atoms. But it's likely to be something much less than that. It would be related to the bond energy. The bonding energy is a function of interatomic spacing for that particular solid. What you would do is you would assume that there's some force constant which is dictated by a quadratic approximation to that using the harmonic oscillator model. And so it would depend on exactly how deep that bonding well is. Obviously, if it's very deep, then the oscillation amplitude will be small. If it's a very weak bond with a broad bonding diagram as a function of interatomic spacing, then the oscillations could be greater. So it would be a function of the solid. And it's, of course, related to the bonding, ultimately. And as a result, there will be a different phonon spectrum for every solid. That should be satisfying to us, because in free electron theory, all solids should be the same. Here we see that there is some difference between different solids, and that's something which we better be explaining as material scientists. Okay. Good. What we'll do in the last 10 minutes, then, is talk now, instead of about the classical theory of phonons, which is basically what we've done thus far, we haven't instituted any quantum mechanics yet, is we'll talk about the quantum theory of phonons. And when we've established the quantum theory, then we'll be able to derive real properties, in particular thermal properties of solids. And as I've just alluded to, the quantum theory of phonons is very similar to the quantum theory of photons. The quantum theory of photons, that is black body radiation, you've probably seen before. It's covered in usually introductory quantum physics courses and or introductory solid state courses, but it's worth going over again because it's so analogous to the behavior of the phonons in solids. So what we're after today and tomorrow will be the quantum theory of the harmonic crystal. Remember, everything I've done thus far was derived from Newton's laws. That's a classical model. No Schrodinger equation, no quantum physics exploited yet. So we're clearly missing something. That's what we want to add. And in particular, since phonons and photons have similar, but I should point out, not identical, behavior, we will first review the quantum theory of photons. And again, for those of you who have seen this before, bear with me. It's probably a good review anyway. If you can derive the Planck black body radiation formula, then the theory of phonons is really trivial because it's the same with some very subtle changes. In particular, the dispersion relation is slightly different. Another difference is that, as we talked about last time, there are three polarizations for phonons, whereas there's only two polarizations for transverse electromagnetic waves. So you have this factor of 3/2, which pops up. The other important difference is that the number of photon modes in a cavity is unbounded. You can have up to infinite number of modes, photon modes in a cavity, whereas in a solid, you have a finite number of phonon modes. The absolute greatest number of phonon modes you could possibly have would be, there's n atoms in a solid, so they could each be oscillating, and they each have 3 degrees of freedom. So you could have 3n total phonon modes possible on a solid. So it's bounded, unlike photons where you could go to infinity. So those are the three differences. But let's first do photons. So remember, photons are really a quantum mechanical entity. In particular, they're relativistic quantum mechanical entities, since photons travel at the speed of light. And what they represent are quanta of the electromagnetic field. And obviously what we're going to then do is come back to phonons, which are quanta of the elastic energy field. So what are the properties of photons? So let me remind you. First of all, photons are identical bosons. With spin 1, unlike fermions, which have spin 1/2. Photons have no mass. This is why, of course, they can travel at the speed of light. And as a result, they're inherently relativistic. We haven't done relativistic quantum mechanics. Fortunately for us, all of the results we need from relativistic quantum mechanics are exactly the same as the results from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So we're just going to use non-relativistic quantum mechanics here and get away with it. But it's because we're working in the special case. So I don't want you to think that all relativistic quantum mechanics is identical to non-relativistic, because it's obviously not. The energy of a photon is Planck's constant times frequency, h nu, or equivalently, h bar omega, where omega is the angular frequency. And h bar is, of course, h divided by 2 pi. Photons have a wave number. Wave number k is 2 pi divided by the wavelength, which is, of course, equal to omega over c. And as a result, the dispersion relation for photons is that omega is linear in k, and the proportionality constant is the speed of light. Again, we can see the analogy to acoustical phonon modes, where again we have a linear dispersion relation, but then we have a slower velocity, of course, since phonons are not massless particles. For a photon, there are two possible spin states. Spin states is code for polarizations. Transverse electromagnetic waves have two polarizations. This implies that the m sub s quantum number is plus or minus 1. So m sub s equal to 0 is disallowed for photons. 6. The number of photons is not a conserved quantity. That is, as temperature increases, the number of photons per unit volume also increases. That's addressing the question we just heard, where I was alluding to this idea of black body radiation where photons can be generated thermally. Okay. So to proceed with the analysis, I ask you to recall a result that we derived a couple days ago from quantum statistical mechanics. So this is really a quantum theory. In particular, from quantum statistical mechanics, we showed that the most probable occupation number for identical bosons was equal to the degeneracy of that energy level, whose label is n, times e to the alpha plus beta times e sub n minus 1. This minus 1 was what was characteristic of bosons. Alpha and beta were Lagrange multipliers, affiliated with conservation of particles and conservation of energy, respectively. So capital N sub n is the most probable occupation number, in this case, for identical bosons. Now, this property here tells us that the number of photons is not a conserved quantity. And that was one of our constraints before. Alpha was conservation of particles. So property number 6 implies that the sum over occupation numbers does not necessarily equal the total number, because the particles are not conserved. And as a result, the Lagrange multiplier alpha does not apply. So that was the beauty of our Lagrange analysis before, is that we can eliminate constraints just by setting the affiliated Lagrange multiplier to zero. So alpha equals zero. Of course, beta, as always, is 1 over kt. That's always true. Property number 3 tells us that energy is just equal to h bar omega. So all we have to determine, and we'll do this next time, is what d sub n is. Once we know what d sub n is, then we just plug in alpha equals 0, beta equal to 1 over kt, e sub n equal to h bar omega. And as a result, it will be in our interest to express d sub n, which of course is just the density of states, in terms of omega. So we'll rederive the three-dimensional density of states, now using the dispersion relation for photons, which is omega equals ck. And that will allow us to express the density states in terms of omega. That'll allow us to write down what the spectrum is for black body radiation. This is the famous Planck result, which initiated the field of quantum mechanics in about the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century. If you then integrate that black body spectrum over all wavelengths, the result will be this t to the fourth dependence for black body radiation, the so-called Stefan-Boltzmann equation. That's where we'll conclude the derivation of the theory of photons, then move on to phonons. Okay? So we will continue next time. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.